Hello, this is Kate McNulty. I'm re-recording our call from yesterday on a sex-positive perspective on sex and porn addiction because, unfortunately, we had some interruptions and distracting sounds on the call. But I'm giving you the same content as we experienced in the call and have added some material. I just want to begin by acknowledging that these are controversial topics in the field of sex therapy, and therapists who have general practices may not be aware of that. But those of us in sex therapy are engaged in ongoing debate about the veracity of the idea of sex addiction or porn addiction and the usefulness of these terms. However, my focus today is on practical clinical techniques for helping both individuals and couples. I'm not differentiating between the terms sex addiction or porn addiction because I'm interested in the effect the behavior has on the relationship. And what I'm seeing is that it seems to be the same, that hurt is caused and there are feelings of betrayal in the partner who feels injured by this behavior. So I'm not likely to focus very much on the usefulness of the terms porn or sex addiction. I'm more trying to give you material and ideas to react to and use in your own practice. I do want to note that my experience with this issue has exclusively been with heterosexual couples. I do hope if there are therapists who are listening and are working with other kinds of relationships, they'll be offering their own training so that we can learn from them. However, although I do see quite a few lesbians and lesbian couples, this doesn't seem to be a problem women are bringing to the office, and I see very few gay men. So the couples and individuals I see are usually in heterosexual relationships, and that's mostly what this call will be about. So what I'd like to do is begin by talking about sex-positive methods for addressing the initial crisis. Because I hope that you recognize when people come into your office for this kind of therapy, with this kind of concern, they're often in a compromised state. People are usually suffering from sleeplessness. They may have decreased appetite, or they may be overeating out of anxiety. People are often in a state of perseveration, ruminating about the events and the conversations they've been having about this subject. People really are in a state of relentlessness with surging emotions. So people who come in for help with this kind of problem are usually in a pretty drastic state. Their relationship may be threatened. They may have family members angry at them and feeling disengaged. They may even have trouble at their job as a consequence of their behaviors. They may be experiencing quite a bit of moral judgment by other people who know about this very private situation. So I'm just encouraging therapists to, as you would with any other circumstance, really when you begin to assess people who come into your office, to think about the level of functioning that they're operating in when they have this kind of stress going on in their lives. So, what we want to do is get to a place where we can help with curiosity and compassion and give the hurt partner some frank acknowledgement of the suffering that's been caused. But I'm encouraging therapists to avoid getting diverted into delving into too much history the first time people come in, or looking for insight in the early phases of this kind of therapy. When I'm working with couples in particular who have these kinds of concerns, my first goal is to help them manage their affect and reduce the level of reactivity that's going on in the relationship. But really, most important is that when people come to see us for the very first time, we're hoping to create enough rapport and enough sense of trust with the client or clients that they'll come back. Because people need to know that they have they can have confidence in the kind of help that you're offering. And if you can let them know that you're working with a model or structure that has some predictability to it, people are likely to experience that as comforting and reassuring. So even if you're newer at this work or don't have that many cases with these kinds of problems, the more that you can assure yourself that you're working toward some kind of structure that works for you, that fits your philosophy and style as a clinician, that's going to give people some sense that you know what to do and they can count on you for good, reliable help. So I'll often begin talking to people about a kind of a three-phase model of the therapy. And I affirm for them in the very first session, I explain after I've heard enough of their story that I have some approximate understanding of what's happening, I'll say something like, you know, we can expect that there's going to be a progression here, and that the first thing that we're going to need to do here is help you in this very real crisis that you're experiencing, whether that's the couple because there's been a discovery or disclosure, or just the individual who's coming in for help. I'll say the same kinds of things. We want to help you manage all of this emotion so that you're avoiding destructive conversations with your partner. And then when things have settled down a bit, we're going to take time to make sense of things. We're going to try to achieve some understanding of how this happened, what exactly did happen that contributed to this situation in your relationship, what laid the groundwork for this to take place in this relationship. So our goal is over time to create it. Now I'm speaking as a clinician. This isn't stuff I say to clients, but over the time, our objective as clinicians is to create an understanding that is coherent to the individual or to the couple, that they can share a narrative about how they got into this state. Because people are propelled into your office when they have these kinds of concerns. There's often been a pivotal event, a discovery, a disclosure, something is found in email or on somebody's phone, a message got intercepted by someone. There's usually a very compelling story going on that the clients are bringing in when they're in these circumstances, because these are very emotionally charged kinds of problems. So our task initially is to help clients diminish the level of affect that they're experiencing, but we can also let them know we'll get to a point where we're sorting out a direction together, and if this is a question for a couple, and there'll be some decision about whether the relationship will continue. Or we'll have to figure out things about forgiveness and create a plan together for moving forward. But mostly, I think, in the beginning of treatment, our job is to encourage people to take the time they need to take to make wise and well-informed choices. Because when you have couples coming in your office who already perhaps have been to a divorce attorney, or you have individuals who already say everybody in their life has advised them to leave this person or to get out of this relationship, you've got a very accelerated set of decisions being faced, and people really don't have the cognitive equipment to make good decisions when they're presenting for this kind of service. So offering people the idea that there's this kind of stage model, and you can construct that in whatever way works for you as a therapist, but that there is a structure and that we're going to help them engage in civil behavior at home. We're going to give them some tools and structure for taking breaks from conversations, letting their partner know when they get overstimulated or overwhelmed, having some regularity about conversations so that they can experience in life at home that they're talking to their significant other in a routine way about these problematic issues, but that doesn't have to be done all at once. We see couples who are getting into marathon conversations with one another, talking for hours and hours at a time until they're exhausted, talking even when there's nothing new left to say. Couples are often getting in repetitive conversations because they desperately want to connect or they want to resolve the problem, but they just don't have the tools on their own to have conversation that moves forward and that is productive. Another thing we want to take leadership with in the early stages of treatment within the first handful of sessions is just to raise the question of if there has actually been physical activity with other people, extramarital, people outside of the committed relationship, to voice that maybe people need to go for medical testing, see their doctor. These are questions that couples don't always know how to raise with one another and may be afraid to ask or feel embarrassed about. So if our taking initiative about that kind of discussion can help them engage in a conversation they need to have, then that's helping them in a very tangible way that they appreciate. We also often have to help people define what they're going to do about monitoring of activity, monitoring cyber activity, online activity of any kind, Of course, we have so much access to technology now. People are monitoring their spouse's comings and goings and whereabouts and correspondence with other people. There are all kinds of levels at which couples can intervene with one another. And we want to help them examine the purpose of that kind of behavior, because there can be so much data flying around at such a quest for facts, quote unquote, and information and details about what people are involved in or have been involved in, that it really diverts the couple from doing the emotional work and reflection that they need to do. So we want to help people. We can't tell couples exactly what to do, but we do want to encourage them to engage in critical thinking together about what's useful and limit their reactivity. So if we can help people see that tracking every movement or asking for a full accounting of their partner's day after they've been apart for a few hours is not useful, then we have to help them replace that with conversation that's about their emotional landscape, conversation that feels reassuring or comforting or searching for understanding. And people often need quite a bit of structure about how to do that. So I'm going to talk now about more things we can do to lay the groundwork for effective conversations about these concerns that are painful and often terribly embarrassing for people. So another function that we can serve is to inquire early on in our contact with people about what kinds of resources they have been using about this problem so far. What information are they being exposed to when they read books or look on the internet? Because there's a lot of bad and misleading information out there. So helping people think about what advice they're getting from people who are close to them, or what sources of information they're turning to, is a really useful service to draw their attention to the fact that something that they read online may not be substantiated anywhere and may just be someone's opinion or one person's experience in their own relationship. And that might not be a source that they want to trust or use as a basis for their own decision making. So we want to help people find more effective means of reassuring one another. And some of that is seeking information and resources together and making use of practical material that's been shown to be helpful. One caller earlier in our call mentioned that this business of having a partner under surveillance and tracking behaviors and whereabouts and so forth can be compared to a parental kind of function, and that we don't want to invite people into parental and child relationships. We want to help them negotiate relationships with some equal level of power and influence together. So I thought that was a good point I just wanted to bring up. I think that we really need to support and reinforce disclosure by, this is a very gendered experience, so I can't help but use gendered language. We want to support and reinforce the disclosure of the husband, I'll just say for simplicity's sake. So typically what I do is I use the format of a joint session to begin with. Most often both people are presenting. Sometimes I get an individual coming in and they're deliberating with a relationship decision, or they've been kind of blown away by a disclosure or an event. So I'll encourage them to bring their partner in. But usually if I'm working with couples, I start with a joint session with the two of them. Then I have a confidential session alone with each person. And then we go back to joint sessions. So another question we considered on our call earlier today was, should those one-on-one sessions be confidential or not? I'm trained in the Gottman method. Gottmans are very clear that they think the one-on-one sessions that they recommend should be open, that you begin the session by advising the partner, please don't tell me anything you don't want your partner to know. Everything is shared and open information in this kind of therapy. But having been in the field of sex therapy as well as doing the Gottman work, I just don't find that useful. I think that's something that I modify because I get much more beneficial information out of having a frank discussion that each person knows is going to be kept private. And I think that what I hear from couples is that even the woman likes the idea that I'm having a confidential conversation with her husband, because then at least somebody knows most of what's going on. Even if the wife can't know that herself, it helps her feel comfortable knowing that I'm holding that information and I'm helping her husband keep his eyes open about that information. Part of what we need to do as time goes by, too, in this kind of therapy, which is usually it takes a while. There's been hurt, trust has been broken, so this is not a 4 or 5 session kind of therapy typically. But over time, as we get to know people better, we have to help the couple keep integrating new information into their shared knowledge base. So sometimes the partner who has strayed, we could call it, or the husband, will have more to say. He wasn't able to say it all in the beginning, and he needs support and backup for bringing in new information and for helping his wife take that in. Sometimes this dynamic has gotten created long before you met the couple, early in the relationship. The wife may have had a history of being hurt or disappointed or betrayed by someone else in her life, and may have told the husband repeatedly, "Never cheat on me. It would kill me. I couldn't bear it if you did this. This would wreck our marriage." So this has become a very high-stakes conversation, often over years. And so to help the wife consider the utility of these warnings, now that this hurt has become real, and to encourage the husband to forge ahead and be thoughtful, but also be brave, and take some risks about what he's willing to let his wife know, because he's gotten a message over, an often very repeated message over time, that it would be unbearable for her to hear about activities, interests, engagement with other people outside the relationship. So the kind of backup that both people need is really considerable. I'm also going to talk a bit about, because I keep hopping back and forth about work with individuals and couples, so I want to talk a bit about how I see us using ourselves when we're in either role, whether we're the individual therapist or the therapist for the couple. I think it's really important that we recognize that no matter what role we're assuming, I really feel like our ethical obligation is to consider the needs of and advocate for the system in these inflammatory kinds of situations. I just don't think it's useful for us to get caught in one person's story. And individual therapy is a great vehicle for a lot of kinds of help. If people have panic attacks or depression or anxiety problems or eating disorders, there are all kinds of ways that individual therapy can be very beneficial for them. But individual therapy has actually been shown to present a risk when it's used to address relational problems. People who come in for therapy about relationship issues specifically, if they present individually, they actually have a higher probability of divorce than people who are not addressing those issues in a one-on-one situation. So I think it's important for us to recognize that isolation does not serve our purposes here. And I think the ideal arrangement is for a couple's therapist to be the hub and to coordinate the care with anyone else who is working with members of a couple. But that happens all too infrequently, and I'm aware that we don't have endless hours to play phone tag, and sometimes it's just very problematic to try to get in touch with somebody else, or clients are hesitant to give us a release, or there's all kinds of reasons that it doesn't happen, but I think it's useful for us to recognize that that's the preferred kind of approach to take, because it helps us contain the whole situation as a team. And stops us working at cross purposes. We don't want to be working in contradiction to what another therapist in the who's part of the system is doing. So I think another thing I'd like to talk about is helping to limit who is drawn in for help, and helping limit the number of influences on this situation. And another aspect of this is helping the wife be concerned, inquisitive, curious in ways that are effective and productive. So we may have situations where one person is doing a lot of help seeking or looking for support. Many times this is a very private matter, and the people you're seeing as clients aren't talking to anyone. They're talking to you because they don't have any confidant. But, of course, people have very different ways of coping. And some people cope by drawing in a cast of thousands. They have a lot of people that they're talking to that want to get a lot of input and advice. And that's another part of your assessment, is to figure out who support people here and are they benefiting the situation and offering a good support to the relationship, or are they interfering or creating more confusion and ambiguity? I think that the other thing about helping the wife ask productive questions or helping the couple have useful exchange is about regulating affect, of course, but also recognizing that a lot of people don't know why they do what they do. And so for the wife to persist in asking the husband why he did what he did is probably not going to be fruitful, and you may need to point out to her very concretely that it doesn't look like you're getting great results from this behavior so far. So can we figure out a different way for you to try to have some of the conversations you feel urgent about, or get some exchange going with your husband? So thinking about framing for her and modeling for her ways to express hurt, worry, concern, really demonstrating tangibly in the office by modeling for her that you can articulate ways that she can seek having her needs met, her needs for information or reassurance or recognition of her hurt in a thoughtful way and in a purposeful way that's not repetitive in nature and that actually allows something new to happen in the couple. So I could give more examples of that, but I'll leave it at that. I think we want to know who may be planting suggestions in these folks' minds and be clear about who's whispering in their ears. Thinking about another question that came up on our call was, what are the techniques for helping people do this? Somebody asked, are you using nonviolent communication techniques, or what methods are you using? And I'm pretty concrete and practical about the way I tend to talk to people, and of course you'll do this in ways that fit your style. But here's an example of, let's say you have a couple come in for the first time or in the second session, and the man is just spilling over with affect, really highly distressed, sobbing, really desperate to let his wife know how terrible he feels. And he's saying things like, I'm a monster. I can't believe I did this. I'm worth nothing. Our lives are ruined. I've wrecked everything. You know, with this high level of affect, a way to reframe what's happening and to validate the reality of how much pain has been caused is to say some phrase like this: to stop that dramatic display, and to just stop and say, you know, let me tell you some about what I'm seeing here. I'm seeing that you are ready to acknowledge that you are a flawed human being who has made some pretty big mistakes and used really poor judgment. You're letting her know that you can see you've hurt her very deeply. And I think that's different from saying that you have an addiction or you can't control yourself or you're a monster. And I'd like to help you get your feet back on the ground and talk and think about yourself in a way that's human and that recognizes you're not the first guy who's ever done this kind of thing. You're not the first person who's made errors in judgment or done things that weren't considered. And that's what we need to work with together. We need to help you figure out how to avoid doing things in this way that is unfortunate and that causes harm. But that this isn't about being monstrous or out of control. You made some decisions that were not good ones. So that's an example of some kind of exchange I might have with somebody who's highly distressed to help them get their breathing back under control and just consider things from a fresh point of view. Another question that came up on our call was about what about things that are more extreme kinds of actions or more repeated kinds of actions, not just having, not just looking at porn online a lot or not just having a liaison with a stranger at work or a coworker or a stranger or something. You know, the question was, what about really repeated behaviors that the caller thought were obviously self-harming or hurtful? So we talked about more habitual behaviors like having sex with strangers in a restroom by the highway or having liaisons with people in the bathhouse or something like that that's more anonymous in nature and may have gone on for years or maybe a high volume of physical sexual contacts with other people. I think in those instances, really our interventions are quite similar, but we want to do more thinking. You know, when someone's expressing this remorse and regret about repetitive behavior, we want to think about the ways in which they're describing their behavior. Is this ego-syntonic behavior or is it ego-dystonic behavior? If it's dystonic, meaning it's not in keeping with how the person sees themselves or not how they want to act, then those are some of the goals that we're setting. And I don't really see that there are radical departures from somebody who has had another kind of indiscretion or unfortunate judgment. But I think this is partly a moral question that we need to grapple with as therapists. And that's part of our work, is keeping our own objectivity about such attention-getting kinds of scenarios that people bring in. So I guess my goal as I go through time with a couple is to help them express their whatever anger and grief they may have about the situation they're faced with, but to hang on to the reality that this is a shared dilemma. They're both in it, and the only way to get out of it is to recognize their relational connection and figure out what they can do to attempt, at least, to attempt soothing one another and acknowledging the unfortunate situation that they're faced with. So I'm going to shift gears here a bit now and talk about ways that you can consider a new perspective to what you're trying to do in your current problematic cases. So we'll move beyond this talk about the initial stages of treatment and talk more about what are we trying to do when people come in with these sexual activities that they regret or that they don't understand or that are causing problems in their lives? I like some thinking that I came across, and I think it's an old textbook on sexuality, from an author named Delameter. This is from 1981. And some of this person's thinking about the styles or modes that we're in when we're being sexual with another person, not necessarily with another person, I suppose, but for the most part, that's what we're talking about, are do we value, there's three aspects to this model. So we can think with people about, do we value procreative sex? Because some people think that's what sex is for, and that if it's for any reason other than procreation, that it may be sinful or indulgent or morally objectionable in some way. And some people value relational sex, of course, that builds a bond between people, that involves attunement, connection, perhaps romance, a focus on the partner, and real observing of the partner in a way that can be very heartfelt and emotionally moving. And some people hold a value for recreational sex. And I think that in the United States, that's a problem for people to accept. A lot of people think recreational sex is frivolous or irresponsible or selfish. There are a lot of judgments that we have about recreational sex. But recreational sex is something some people also find transporting. It can feel transcendent to them. It may be a very meaningful spiritual experience to have recreational sex with another person. So I think if we hold on to some concepts like this, this can help us support the person we're working with in really examining and reorganizing their view of what sexuality means to them, individually and in the relationship. And that, I think, is a quality of really valuable therapy. I think that's an indisputably useful service to provide to people, and we're not doing enough of that. That's my opinion. So part of what I see, I mentioned earlier that this is an entirely gendered experience that we're talking about, but I don't see a lot of discussion about gender when I look at the literature about whatever we want to call it, problematic sexual behavior, out-of-control sexual behavior, sex addiction. You know, there are all these terms being bandied about, but I think we go in and out of reductionist thinking and systems thinking, and each has their use. Reductionist thinking, though, is breaking things down into their individual components like you would if you were doing a recipe or building a car or building a machine. You have to understand what the different parts do and how they function together. But if we're doing systems thinking, that gives us a broader view. That gives us a greater capacity to see the whole and to understand the way everything functions when it's in motion. So I see that in our field, we're really getting drawn into thinking about this reductionist material on, you'll see people with brain scans and talking about dopamine and a lot of ideas and information about the effects of porn on the brain, for instance, or what kind of sex constitutes addictive sex. And I'm afraid I think that's just a very, very limited view that's not taking the whole picture into account, because if we just look at biochemistry in this reductionistic way or look at brain scans in this way, we're losing our capacity for systems thinking. We're not applying it, I should say. And we're losing the lens of culture. And if we think about culture and gender and what gender roles dictate in our time in history about sexuality, I think that tells us an awful lot about why all these events and activities are happening for people, and people are playing out a lot of things about their cultural scripts that aren't being talked about in therapists' offices. So that's just something I'm going to say a lot more about in the future in another call probably or another class, but for now I just want to plant that seed of an idea for you and have you consider, why are we not looking more at gender and the way gender plays out into our sexual selves? So I also encourage you to look at some critiques of the conventional thinking just in the addictions field. I'm not here to tear anybody down. I know most of us are doing this work for really good purposes. We just really want to help. But there's an awful lot we have not figured out yet about addictions of any kind, much less sex addiction, which is just a name somebody came up with probably 15 years ago or 20 years ago or something, I think. So you could look at the literature of Stanton Peel. He's a critique of the addiction treatment industry, and to my knowledge, he was the first person to use the term love addiction, and later he talked about sex addiction, but he seems to disavow the sex addiction industry. Another author you could look up is Anne Fletcher. She is not a mental health person. She is a journalist, and she's done extensive research on the rehab industry and how addiction is conceptualized. So those are a couple of names I wanted to drop. I think there's a lot we could do with models of adult development and looking at ego development and applying some of those theoretical concepts to this field. I don't see anybody doing that yet. But mostly, as a clinician, I want to think about intent versus outcomes. I want to help clients understand that the harm caused is more important than what their intent was. And part of being responsible and a grown-up is to recognize and acknowledge what hurt you may have caused because you were trying to get needs met, but you didn't really understand your own motivations or the impact you'd have on another person. So we've got an ambitious task. Even when we can quell the initial crisis, this is a big job to do with clients, to help them really examine and step back from these deep, embedded parts of themselves that most of us are taught are secret, not to be discussed with other people, to be kept private. And so there hasn't been a lot of light shed on the sexual self for most of the people we see in our offices. So giving them space to tell and expand on their story in a calm way, in a reasoned, measured way that's not inflammatory, that's not blaming, is something that we're doing. We need to give them both, for the guy, he needs both backup, because everybody's ready to shame and blame and tear down men's sexuality. We're living in a time that's very confusing about what are okay ways for men to express themselves sexually. And we need to be a backup person for the guy who's in our offices. At the same time, we need to be ready to challenge them and help them examine their own behaviors and take responsibility for things they've done that have been imprudent or ill-advised. So I want to talk a bit about a particular model of couples therapy that, again, I think this is useful, whoever's in your office, even if you're just seeing an individual. It's a good concept to have. So Dan Weil is a couples therapist and trainer who I have a great deal of respect for. He's in the Bay Area. His name is spelled Dan Weil, D-A-N-W-I-L-E. And I like Dan's work because he is very elegant in his conceptualizing of things. And one idea that he gives couples therapists is that if we really distill the possibility of couples interactions at any given time down into their most simple components, we can think about three pathways any one person can take in a conversation. So at any given time when we're talking with our partner or any intimate that we care about, we can be engaged in attacking. Of course, that's not useful, and it's to be avoided. So we may be attacking, we may be avoiding, or we may be confiding. And it's no mystery to figure out which of these is the most useful. Of course, we're all prone to doing the attacking, avoiding. But if you, as a therapist, can just hold on to the thought that this is like a compass for you in session when you're seeing couples particularly, but even encouraging your individual clients in their own lives outside the room with you, that we want to encourage people to confide. We want to encourage disclosure. We want to encourage offering vulnerabilities and taking the risk of letting somebody else really see what's going on in our inner world, because that's what holds the potential for connection with another person. When we're in that state of confiding, that's when people are drawn closer to us. They want to exercise mutual care. They feel attracted to us, and they want to help us, because that's a very natural human impulse. So helping couples make use of that simple idea of, are you attacking, avoiding, or confiding right now, gives them it's like rails that a train goes on. You know, it's just some way that they can kind of hold their thought on what are we trying to do right now. So along with helping people manage their behaviors in conflict and in delicate situations, we want to help them begin framing an explanation for their behavior, an explanation that's palatable to both of them, if you're seeing the couple. So for a lot of men that I see, of course, there's so many people. There's just a thousand ways that people defend themselves psychologically, but some of the most typical patterns I see in terms of motivation and what's going on behind the scenes are about men's sexuality involving cutting off a part of themselves psychologically, creating walls within themselves, having a sense that their sexual self may be unacceptable to other people, or it's shameful, or it would be rejected. And so those are some of the reasons that people may seek contact with other than their partner, because they don't know that their partner can really understand or accept them and their desires. Men sometimes feel, any of us do, but men in particular may feel a sexual charge associated with keeping secrets. There's something powerful about keeping secrets. It means that we've got one over on the other person. There's a way that when we have a secret, we get to hold something that just belongs to us. I think in our culture in particular, men are very identified with their work. Many men don't really have much of a model about how to be a good husband or partner other than being a hard worker, being the breadwinner, selflessly working long hours or taking on extra responsibilities in their job or trying to advance and accelerate their careers. That's a way that they know to demonstrate caring many times and show their commitment to family. So that can also involve some sacrifices. Sometimes we see men have ended up in these kinds of situations because they are doing so little for themselves. They're doing so little self-care. They're doing so little recreation. They have so little social life that going and doing something underhanded or secret, kind of getting away with something, can feel like a way to give to themselves. It can feel like a way to preserve a self that's independent of the relationship and to have something that's fulfilling, gratifying, thrilling, on the side, can give a sense that even with all my devotion to my family and all the sacrifices I make and the way that I am depriving myself, here's a way I get to have. I have something, and it's only for me, and no one else needs to know about it. That way nobody needs to know my needs. Sometimes people are just afraid of asking their partner to have their sexual needs met in the relationship. And the thing that seems most prevalent to me is that people are just plain and simple unskilled at asking for their sexual needs to be met. They don't have language. They don't know the terms to use. They feel shy about saying the body parts, saying the words. They may just be unequipped with a sexual vocabulary. They don't have a sexual voice. Where would most people learn that in our world? We don't really offer young people a lot of information. We're left to make things up for ourselves by usually watching media and modeling that for ourselves. And many people are in relationship without knowing how to attend to their own needs, their own intimate needs. So I think this has a lot to do with why we're seeing such a prevalence of these problems these days. And I just think it's unfortunate and short-sighted to say, well, this is a problem of addiction or these other more simplistic answers. I know the phrase out-of-control sexual behavior is an attempt to say something that's more neutral, that's less value-laden, but I also take issue with this idea of being out of control. I think there are ways that men are excused in our culture, and we have an image that they tend to lose control. And I dispute that. I think men are making choices, and part of their healing, part of their being accountable, is taking responsibility for the choices that they've made and being able to account to another person for what happened. What was the kind of behavior chain that led me to pick up the phone, to look on Craigslist, to answer this person's ad, pull over my car into the parking lot and go to the strip club and get a lap dance. So I think that we're still groping in this field, and I'm concerned that there are too many people saying that they know what this is all about and they've got it figured out, and that is not my stance. I think that this is a very new specialization, and because of the growth of technology and ability to reach out to people online in anonymous ways, look at pornography without anyone knowing. There's a groundswell of this kind of behavior in the general population, but I don't believe that therapists have figured out very much at all yet about what. I think that we need to have some humility and acknowledge that we're learning along with the clients, and I've been doing this for a while, so this is not new to me, but I think we need to acknowledge that we don't know everything about this. So I'm just going to review a bit about some of the ways that we can help people by creating a positive therapeutic alliance with them when they come into our offices. I've got some ideas that are about regulating dynamism and passivity. I think we want to be thoughtful as we're intervening with couples to recognize that often what's coming in, what people are bringing in terms of their behaviors is we've got a wife who's in pursuit of her husband, who has many, many questions, has a lot of pain that she needs to have him see and hear and recognize, and a husband who's in largely passive withdrawal, wondering what is it going to take to get his wife to stop talking. So part of our challenge is to figure out how to keep the conversation balanced. I'm not necessarily an advocate of 50% and everybody has to have equal time, but I do want to support the person who's not speaking, perhaps attempt, as Dan Weil would do, to speak for them, to speak on their behalf and with their permission, and just ask them for feedback. Ask them, is this how it is for you? Or are these some of the things that might be going on for you now? And get their endorsement of what's going on by just making guesses. Maybe you need to make many guesses before you can hit the mark. But at some point, the person's going to nod, or their posture will soften, or they may get tears in their eyes. But if you can speak on behalf of the person who's quieter, I think that's going to really help create a profound alliance, and people will really have a visceral emotional response if you get it somewhere in the neighborhood. You don't have to be perfect. You just try. And it's a little like going to another country where maybe you try to speak the language and you do it imprecisely, but most people appreciate that you're trying. So it's a little bit like this. We've all got our own culture inside. We're all our own world. We live in our own world, and so if we can show people we're attempting to understand and we're really stretching to get their experience, then that's going to be a very joining thing for them. We also want to think about whose agenda are we serving in any given conversation, and making sure that, again, there's a balance there so that, yes, of course, we're supporting the person who's justifiably hurt, outraged, indignant, feels betrayed, has lost trust, all those things. We need to back that person up and let the woman know we get it, and this is terribly difficult, and there's been a great deal placed at risk oftentimes, but that we also need to offer that kind of backup to the man who's in the office with us. We talked a bit about coordinating with other therapists, and I think people by and large appreciate that if they're seeing somebody else and you're willing to make the call or take some leadership in initiating contact, people typically appreciate that because these problems are serious enough that they really recognize they need all the help they can get. I think another possibility would be just thinking about how the woman who is... The dynamic is often that the person who has caused the hurt, the man, wants to think about anything but this. He wants to burrow down into his work. He wants to be busy. He might want to do stuff to show that he cares. He might do more projects around the house, or he might take the kids out of the house more on the weekends, or do things to demonstrate his involvement and his caring. But oftentimes the person who has created the hurt doesn't want to have to process it and keep talking over it again and again because it's so painful. And yet the person who has been hurt can't stop talking, is obsessed, essentially, is just ruminating and combing over every detail, looking at the past and trying to think, how did I miss this? Or how long was this going on? Or how many people? Or where did he find this person? So they've got a big task to kind of piece together reality retrospectively and to help them recognize that for a while, it's probably going to be kind of like those programs that are operating in the background in your computer. You're going to have an internal voice that's doing that. It's going to be very hard to quiet the noise for a while. But letting them know with empathic comments like that, that you can see, you get how much of a struggle this is for them and how much pain they're in, what hard work this is to go through this, and that you have some glimmer of understanding of what their experience is like. I want to talk a bit too about going back to this idea of an actual addiction being present. I think part of what's affirming the idea of an addiction is just the language we use to talk about it. I've heard therapists say, "Well, I have some men on my caseload, and they've been looking at pornography, and we're trying to help them stop, and they're getting to a place where they've cut back on their activity, or they're not seeing the woman they had the fling with at the office anymore because they got transferred to a different department." But they come in, the therapist will say, they come in, and they're telling me they're in withdrawal. They're having cravings. How am I supposed to help them with that? So again, I think we're using a very approximate kind of metaphor here to represent some human experience that's not necessarily accurate. And so the more we can help people empathically by recognizing, it sounds like it's hard to be apart from her. It sounds like even though you know this event hurt your wife, you really miss that woman that you were involved with at work. Or being able to say, I know, it seems like porn is a way you've really been taking care of yourself for a long time. It's one way you've been able to let yourself off the hook and stop thinking about work and pressures for a while. So it's totally natural that you would want to go back to doing that because it's a habit that served you for a long time. It probably hasn't been the best way to take care of those needs, but it's totally understandable that that's something you still feel pulled to do, and yet it sounds like you and your wife have agreed that's hurtful to her, or those are behaviors that you've agreed not to do for now, at least until the two of you can get your feet under you and she's feeling better. I've had comments from women like, I feel like my husband has 100 mistresses and they live upstairs on the computer. Women feel very threatened even just by imagery online because they get all kinds of inadequacies and doubts stirred about their own physical attractiveness and their husband or partner's connection with them. So whether these are, again, I just believe that whether these are actual 3D physical activities out in the world or online activities, they can create the same sensation of being threatened and feeling betrayed. So we need to honor that in people and not quibble with our terminology. So I'd like to also just refer you to a resource for helping people. I think another function we can serve in these kinds of circumstances is to help people develop their own definition of and parameters for sexual health and self-care. And I think that's a truly adult task. People need to be self-possessed to do that. They need to have a kind of psychological curiosity about themselves, and we can engage their imaginations, their sense of values, and their belief systems in doing this. And I think that this is a kind of conclusion of this type of therapy, is to get people to a developmental state where they find this an engaging activity, a conversation to have with one another, and over the course of time, it can really build a bond for people to be able to talk on that level. Those are truly intimate, personal kinds of conversations to have that are deeply meaningful and move people out of the realm of superficial sexuality and sense of self. So one good resource I like to refer people to do is just to Google World Health Organization and look up their statement on sexual health. So you just Google World Health Organization, definition of sexual health. There's a lot of information there. As far as I know, this is some of the best, well-thought-out material on kind of universal agreements we can reach about what helps people feel good in their sexual lives and be mature and help them get the information that they need. So I hope this has been helpful. I welcome any feedback from anyone who's listening. And my name is Kate McNulty, and this talk has been about a sex-positive perspective on sex and porn addiction. And you're welcome to get in touch with me anytime and let me know your feedback or thoughts about this presentation. I'll look forward to more. Thank you for listening.